This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This is Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, a look back through 45 years of KBOO Radio. I'm Dan Johnson.
And I'm Bob Bailey. I chaired the KBOO board during the nearly 2 years it took to purchase the building and remodel it in 1981, 82, and probably even dribbled into 1983 in the facilities that's occupied today by KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th. It was, all in all, through the kindness of angels, serendipity, passionate and quirky people, a dose of luck, and a lot of community involvement that the place got built with basically a shoestring budget. And it took longer than expected, as most things do. But even for all the effort and anxiety, I am proud as hell of that effort that is now 30 years in the past. Ha! And we thought it was a big deal that KBOO had been around for 15 years at that time. The building was truly for the future, an incredible asset to the community that enabled KBOO to be the fixture in Portland that it is today.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us here on KBOO as we celebrate our 45th anniversary.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, give us a little background, if you will. Tell us about how you became involved with KBOO and the progression of things that led you to the board of directors and things moved from there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I had moved to Salem in 1977 from the South Coast, and was in listening range on a good day to KBOO. And I started listening to both the music from the True Vine that Michael O'Rourke was running, as well as the early days of Pablo I and the reggae show, and I just loved it. And then in 78, I moved on up to Portland and became an avid listener. But didn't really get involved in the station. But in middle of 1981, there was an opening on the board of directors, and I thought, you know, that's something I could do because I didn't really have time to be on the air. So I volunteered to fill that slot, and being a warm body, I was accepted. And really, at my very first meeting, which was held in the room above the Patty's restaurant downtown, we got the news that we were going to have to move. And so there ensued the scramble to find a new space and the questions as to whether to rent, lease, or buy. My God, where are we going to get the money? And that took a good 6 or 8 months.
How many people were on the board at that time, and were they all involved with you in this looking for a new facility?
I think there was a total of 7 people on the board, and I volunteered to work with the station manager at that time, who was Vicky Tempe, who had just come on board. She and I think there was one other person involved in looking around, searching for a new building space.
Give us an idea of the kind of space that you were looking for.
We were looking for something central to downtown. We felt it was important to be downtown, both because of what it meant to the city. We didn't want to be in a burb, and we wanted to be near good transit. We looked at a number of sites that they had to be affordable. We had to be something that would be achievable. And it really ended up boiling down to two buildings. This, the one that we're in today at 20 Southeast H, which at that time was a warehouse for a wholesale electrical parts distributor. And it had been in this man's family for some time, and they were looking to expand their operation and move out of the building. The other place, we looked at a couple other places on the inner southeast side, one down, further down Southeast 7th, down near Play Street, but it was a much larger space and more expensive. And then there were a couple of others that really didn't work out. But A, it had to be affordable and had to be about 50,000 square feet.
And when you say affordable, give us a picture of what affordable would have been for you folks then.
We thought, as I recall, something in the ballpark of $35,000 to $50,000.
To purchase a building.
And then whatever the renovation costs were going to be on top of that.
And when you finally found this location, did you envision the amount of work at that time that it would take to convert this into a radio station with everything that would be needed?
You could never really envision that sort of thing. It's like remodeling the house. If you knew what you're going to go through, you probably wouldn't do it in the first place. But no, we knew it was going to be a lot of work. But when we saw the space and saw the potential and the location, and the owner at that time was a KABU listener, and was willing to give us a real break on the financing of it and sort of delaying payment, we started dreaming immediately that this was the spot.
Do you remember how much we paid for the building?
I don't really, no.
Yeah.
But it was not more than about $50,000, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay. Now, after you prepared to move into the building, how much of the work to actually put up the walls, put the equipment in, the whole nine yards. How much of that was volunteer work?
Great question. Volunteers were absolutely key. I mean, we hired almost nothing done here. A man named Steve Law was our volunteer coordinator. Today, I think Steve is a reporter for the Portland Tribune, or at least last I knew he was. Steve was our volunteer coordinator, and our objective in hiring the project manager was to hire somebody who was both experienced as a project manager, but who not only wanted to work with or was willing to work with volunteers, but liked to do that. And we ran across a great guy named Anthony Stoppiello, who was an architect by training, but had worked on lots of sort of build-it-yourself projects with volunteers. And Anthony came in, and between he and Steve Law, almost the entire thing was done with volunteers. Steve was really good about plugging into the trades unions around town, the electrical workers, the sheetrock guys, the carpenters, and so on, and got them to target their apprenticeship training programs on KABU. So it became a huge task for him and for Anthony of scheduling the trade unions and their apprentice programs to come in and do the work and do it in the right sequence, as well as volunteers from KABU who stepped forward. We had a number of people, names I don't remember, who were experienced in carpentry and concrete laying and electrical and all that, who volunteered to come down too. So, and we got an enormous amount of the materials, the studs and plywood and glass and all that stuff, donated or really at low cost. So it was a huge effort on the part of Anthony and Steve in particular to coordinate the flow of people and goods, some of which was pretty random, into a schedule that we could meet.
Now, we're in production room one, mm-hmm. which is the larger of our two production rooms. As the room is laid out with the equipment that we have and all that, I would assume that this isn't the same control board that y'all put in here when we started.
That looks like it to me, that this is not the same one.
And I would imagine there were other things there that we no longer have, like an 8-track player or carts and reel-to-reel. Well, we do have one reel-to-reel over in the other production room, but did you have to go out and get a lot of new equipment, or was this something where you just you know, banged it all out from the old location to the new one.
That was a lot of it, was bringing over what had been in the old location. There was a lot of good core equipment that Pooh Rogers and others worked on to plug in. It was in the design process. It was really interesting because I want to give a shout out to a man named Howard Shapiro, who was an architect, who volunteered his time to design the building, which was not easy. It's never easy to work for a complicated client. So Howard worked with the technical staff here at the station, the engineering staff, as well as the the station manager, to make sure that when the studios were constructed, they were constructed so that they were receptive to a future of technology that we didn't know about. You could plug things into them, take old stuff out, put new stuff in. That the windows between the studios were soundproof. That the walls between the studios were on separate studs, that it wasn't just sheetrock on one side and sheetrock on the next side. So he paid a lot of attention to how the studio was designed for radio purpose, as well as having to lay out the office areas, the archives, and so on.
Bob, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to continue our discussion about KABU celebrating 45 years of being on the air, something that we're quite proud of. If you're a history buff, which I am, you're really going to appreciate that. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, I have Bob Bailey in the studio with us. This is Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, a look back through 45 years of KABU Radio. I'm Dan Johnson. Now, Bob, let's go back a little bit. I know before we started recording this interview, you were showing Kathleen and I some sketches and some articles that appeared, and one of them was about a fundraiser for $15,000 written by somebody from the Oregonian.
Yes. As the station was constructed and we were moving along, it became clear that we really needed cash on top of all the volunteers and all the donated material. We needed about $15,000 in the summer of 1982 to really put us over the top and get the porta potties off the street and get the staff in the building in a good way. So we began a campaign of fundraising. Margaret Strawn, who at that time was the city commissioner, was the honorary chair. We did a one-square-foot campaign. Everybody, the idea was people would buy a square foot of the new building, and it would add up to the $15,000. And a man named Rick Mitchell, who at that time was also a KABU volunteer and jazz programmer, but who also wrote for the Oregonian as a music critic, did a really nice piece in the Oregonian in July of 1982, summarizing our plight and kind of where we were and referencing the need to raise $15,000 to $16,000 to finish it.
Who were some of the other key players that you worked with during that time? On the board with you and other folks that were involved?
Yeah, boy, you would ask me that. Well, certainly Vicki Tempe, today Victoria Stapiello, who as the station manager was key. Michael O'Rourke was on the board, and he was just super. Shahid Hamid, who is still programming today, was also on the board. He came on sort of in the latter stages of this, but Shahid was terrific.
George Page?
George was not on the board, but he was around and a huge supporter of this thing. So I can't recall, unfortunately, everyone who was on the board.
Don't worry about it, Bob. I've got that problem where I can't even remember if I put my shoes on in the morning. So, you know, I want to ask a question now as we're starting to move towards the other end of the scale here. We've both been around a while, and I know that in this day and age and in this economy that for a radio station, makes no difference what genre, what type of radio station it is, to succeed and stay on the air costs a lot of money. What would you attribute KABU's success in being a community radio station to stay on the air, go through good times and bad, and still come out at the end of the day serving the needs of the community?
It's obviously the people. The passion of everybody that's involved at KABU, whether they're on-air programmers, whether it's people who do the scheduling, people that serve at the front desk, on the boards and various committees, there are people here who will not let this go. I mean, they will stay up weekends and evenings working on this thing. So it's the passion of people who just have this thing in their clenched in their jaws, and they're not going to let it go. And it's been a succession of a handoff from passionate person to passionate person. Sometimes that makes things difficult. I mean, you get a lot of people motivated to be on committees or on the board who are very passionate about their piece of KABU. And often, that people don't always play well together because they are so passionate. But that's the difference. And it's not about the money. It's not about the corporate return. It really is about the community. And I'm just so amazed and pleased and feel like the whole community is blessed because KABU is here.
Now, for you personally, how has KABU impacted your life, especially if you look back to those early days when you were on the board and you were going through a lot of searching and looking for that right place? But bringing it right back to today, how has KABU impacted your life personally?
In several ways. Well, one is obviously the people I've met over the years through KABU and the shared interests that we've had. I still am in touch with a number of people that I've worked with or met through the station. The other thing is obviously the tie to the information that comes out, the things I learn, if not on a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis from KABU. It expands my world. It keeps me in touch with a whole current of water flowing underground, as it were, that springs forth on KABU, things I'm not going to find elsewhere. And probably the last thing is I just love the variety and the music. And for me, there's no better day than Saturday on KABU, in which the whole day is I'm just blessed with the programming that's on, starting with swinging country in the morning all the way through to blues and the African music and Grateful Dead. So it's personally, it's pleasurable, it's informative, and it has enriched my life with the people I've met and the things I've learned.
Well, Bob, I want to tell you that it's been a pleasure talking to you. I think that you've provided a lot of insight for us into the early days. But I have to ask you, okay, you've got a great radio voice. Did you ever do any programming or on-air work?
No programming. I came in and did a lot of pledge pitching, but I was in a position both personally and professionally that I really couldn't commit to a program. I thought about it now that I've retired. I live in Salem these days, and there's a new community station in Salem, KMUZ, and I know some of the folks there. And so who knows? I may drift over and do a program.
Sure. Sure. You know, I've learned by my own personal experience that once you're inside a radio station and you see the magic that takes place, you just don't want to leave. And so I can understand that. I've been that same way myself, and it's been a fun experience. Well, one last shot from you, Bob. Tell us what you think about KABU achieving 45 years of being on the air in Portland.
Well, I think it's a tribute both to the volunteers, the people that have flowed through this station over the years and put their shoulder to the wheel. The other thing is I think what we see today in Portland, the phenomenon of Portlandia, blah, 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 all that stuff, I think it's directly attributable to KABU. I honestly think that KABU has had a big influence in attracting and retaining the kind of people who are interested, who are outgoing, who are not afraid of some creativity. I think KBOO has played a huge role in what Portland, the livability of Portland today, if not beyond.
And the programming, has it stayed pretty consistent as well?
Yeah, it's a slow evolution over time. I mean, in the early days, it was when I first joined the board, the classical morning concert was the big deal. And eventually choosing to get rid of that after the KBPS came along was very painful. So that's transitioned. But many of the of the programs are still the same or variations on a theme.
Right. Well, Bob, thank you very much. Folks, you've been listening to Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, a look back through 45 years of KBOO Radio. Stay tuned. We'll return. And when we do come back, we'll have Sheila Rubens. You'll remember her from many years ago, right here on KBOO 90.7. Is Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, a look back through 45 years of KBOO Radio. I'm Dan Johnson. You know, for 45 years, KBOO Community Radio has brought you programming of all types to fit the needs of listeners that frankly, just couldn't find what they wanted through other media sources. Well, one thing that's remained true from the first day that we started broadcasting right up to this day in history, it's taken people like Sheila Rubin to help focus and set a path for us. And believe it or not, I have Sheila Rubin on the phone with me. Delighted to have you, Sheila. Welcome to KBOO.
Dan, thank you so much. I am so delighted to be talking with you. It has been so many years.
When did you first come to KBOO, and what brought you here?
Well, it was 1979. I was 21 years old, and I was on a personal quest. I had 3.5 years of communications, radio, and TV training at Southern Illinois University, and I wanted something different. I wanted to find alternative media. I wanted to teach people through technology how to communicate their story and their world and their vision, and that was my vision. So I was on in my van. I was on a vision quest. I was going to different cities and communities and trying to figure out, you know, how can I help and what is out there. And I came to Portland, Oregon, and someone in Portland, Oregon told me there's this amazing alternative station. You've got to hear it. You know, you've got to hear it. You know, and they turned it on the radio for me. I was so excited, and all I heard was dead air. And, you know, as a broadcaster, dead air is not something that we're supposed to be doing. So
not a good thing.
I was a little surprised. So I thought, you know, what's going on? And then I heard a lot of dead air, and then I heard Jane Bloom's lovely voice say, "Oh, I am so sorry. I have both of my guests in the studio, but I can't figure out how to plug in the cables to get their microphones through the board, so I can't do that interview today. We'll have to do it next week." And so that was my introduction to KBOO, and my first thought was, oh, my goodness. And then my second thought was, well, they really need me. So I decided to volunteer there and teach them, you know, audio technique and how to use the microphones and how to plug them into the board.
Radio 101.
Right, and I thought I would do that, and I, you know, started off in, you know, the public affairs department, and also I started off, you know, as one of the women's sole programmers. And I got hired as a production coordinator, which meant my job was to teach everyone, and there were 300 people, teach everyone better audio technique, how to use the microphones, which end to plug in, you know, how to not put the tape on backwards, you know, when you're, you know, and we were an NPR affiliate at that point, so we were trying to, you know, tape off of NPR and put that on the air, and people
right.
would call me. And
now for our, Sheila, let me interrupt for just a second. For our newer listeners, folks that have only been listening for a couple of years or so, this period in history, the radio station was actually located downtown. Is that not correct?
Yes, we were on Yamhill. I think it was like 65 Southwest Yamhill. I don't remember exactly, but it was on Yamhill in a very beautiful building, very beautiful, location. And the Willamette River was about, you know, half a block away. So I would go out on my lunch break and fly a kite in the Willamette River. And during that time, Mount St. Helens exploded. So during that first year at KBOO, we would be running up to the roof on the Yamhill building, and we'd climb up the stairs and we'd open the roof access door, and we would be on the roof watching Mount St. Helens blow up. It was quite amazing.
Now, did you report from the rooftop?
Well, I can't actually remember if we did or we didn't. I think my frustration was, we didn't have a news department in those days, and I made it my mission, you know. I was like, I'm going to start a news department, and so I got Michael Wells, was the amazing program director in those days, and I asked him if he would send me down to KPFA, because, you know, I really, you know, that was, you know, that was like, you know, they really know how to do news. So he paid for me to take the Green Tortoise down to KPFA, and I, you know, studied there for a week how to do news, how to do reporting, how to do recording of news, how to do interviews, get them on the air, how to do the tape, and, you know, basically how to put together a news show.
Sure.
So I came back, and I, asked for volunteers, you know, who wanted to do news. So I'd been training people how to work with microphones and do live, you know, recordings and of music and people, but, you know, I said, who wants to learn how to do news? And there were probably about, you know, 10, you know, people that were very interested. And so I trained them in how to do news, and we put together a little newscast, and it was, people loved it. We had our little half-hour newscast. I think it was either late afternoon or evening, but that was, you know, everybody loved that. And we, the volunteers were so successful, you know. I, you know, started the news programming through training all these people and, you know, showing them how to do it. So I was one of the newscasters, but I rapidly, you know, wanted to turn that directorship over to someone. So we hired Sarah Cardin from the Santa Cruz station, and she was with us for a couple months. But her news style was to kind of do it by herself. And we really wanted it to be,
more of a community effort.
Yes, you understand. So we decided that she would go back to Santa Cruz, and that we hired Ross Reynolds from the Midwest. Came out, and he, you know, really loved the volunteers, and he took news to a very professional level, and he took the volunteers that I had trained and trained them even further, and he really added, you know, he deepened the news station, and it, you know, eventually became what it is today. But that, you know, that didn't used to exist, and so that was just kind of a little dream of mine, and a number of people that, you know, put in their volunteer effort, and, you know, Ralph Colson and Barbara Bernstein and, you know, Stephen Queener, and a lot of people, you know, Elsie Ernest, really, really, you know, gave their volunteer hours to the news station.
The following KBOO News Team report took place in May, just one day after the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 1 minute after 7. Time for the KBOO Evening News.
Good evening. Mount St. Helens is a little quieter today, but scientists say that situation could change without warning.
We have an on-the-spot report on the effects of the ash fall in eastern Washington.
Many black students stayed home from school today in Portland in protest of school district desegregation plans.
It's still on the horizon, but the Bonneville Power Administration wants to increase its electricity rates.
And there was a large anti-nuclear rally in town over the weekend.
These and other stories are in tonight's news. I'm Bruce Cutler.
And I'm Sarah Carden.
And this is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, the 19th of May.
Mount St. Helens is having a comparatively quiet day today after its major eruption yesterday. Although activity is continuing, the volcano has quieted down enough for scientists to get a look at the effects of that eruption. To put it mildly, those effects have been considerable. To begin with, the mountain has literally blown part of itself to pieces. Mindy Brugman of the U.S. Geological Survey describes a new summit of St. Helens.
Well, the last time I looked at it, there was just, it looks like a large horseshoe, and looks as if the north or northwest flank is blown out. And the summit of the crater, the summit of the mountain is now much different than before, of course, and is maybe more than 1,000 feet lower than it was before. And the whole morphology of the mountain has changed considerably on the north half.
Scientists also report that an area extending 15 miles from the volcano has been stripped totally void of vegetation. This is a result of the large amounts of ash, steam, and hot gases which St. Helens is continuing to emit. There are also reports of new gas vents along the Toutle River, and mudflows and debris have filled in at least one-third of Spirit Lake. Yesterday's eruption also sent off a huge ash cloud, which has caused problems for areas east of the volcano as far away as Wyoming. Eastern Washington has been the hardest hit, with travel still impossible in that area. Agriculture officials there are worried that the deposits of ash, as deep as 4 inches in some areas, have seriously damaged crops. What's next for the volcano? No one really knows. Mindy Brugman.
I don't know what other people are saying, but I'm saying this is quite unpredictable, and I think probably most people here will agree with it. There could be a possibility for other eruption, but this kind of general trend that I was told by other people in the office is that it would tend to have a, with time, and I don't know how long of a time, have a acidic plug of magma that is the one that obviously has been moving up and is still below the volcano, will sometime reach the surface, probably in this crater that has developed. And so the initial stage that we've gone through yesterday might not have to be repeated.
There is one thing scientists are certain of, though. The area surrounding St. Helens is extremely dangerous and will remain that way for the foreseeable future. Brugman told KBOO that anyone trying to get past official roadblocks to get closer to the mountain is probably risking their life.
Now, when you went out, and did you actually take recorders and go out and gather news stories?
Yes, yes. These were the days. This was before electronic news gathering.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, it was the days of in video. You know, people had like these black and white half-inch tape portapacks if they were doing, you know, news for TV. And then for radio, we had these little, you know, cassette tape recorders, and then we would go out, you know, there was a strike at the library, you know, I went out, you know, I put on my reporter's hat, and I got my microphone, and I interviewed, you know, the head of the library, and then I interviewed the head of the union, and I put it together and, you know, and rushed back for the 5 o'clock deadline or whatever it was in those days, and, you know, got it, you know, and so people would have their little bits of news, and we'd be, you know, leaning over each other in the production room because there weren't, there's never enough tape recorders, and everything was kludged together with duct tape, but, you know, it was amazing. So, yeah, we did live reading of news. We ran tape. We usually had several different tapes that we had gathered, you know, from the community. It was very exciting.
The eruption of Mount St. Helens was not the only thing going on over the weekend. On Saturday, Portland was witness to its biggest anti-nuclear demonstration ever. By official estimate, over 4,000 people gathered in Waterfront Park to hear speeches and music aimed at showing the dangers of nuclear power. The main focus of the rally was to oppose the construction and continued use of nuclear plants such as Trojan. There was also a concerted attempt to show the connections between nuclear power issues and other issues involving the community. One of the first speakers was Bev Steiner, chief lawyer for the Public Power Campaign. According to Steiner, there is a direct link between private ownership of utilities and the fact the same utilities are staunch supporters of nuclear power.
The private utility monopolies have a stranglehold on the energy resources of our state. Under their control, we have found our lives endangered and the decisions about our future made by corporate heads and bankers. We need to wrench the private monopolies' hands off the levers of expertise, money, and jobs. They turn the financial faucet on full blast for nuclear power and only allow a few drops to flow towards renewable resources and conservation. We don't have to continue on the private power path. Around the state, people are joining to form people's utility districts. These people's utility districts will replace the private utility decision-making with locally elected boards.
Stein said the creation of PUDs will help Oregon make a transition to the use of alternative energy sources. Russ Redner of the American Indian Movement spoke of the damage the nuclear industry has already done to Native Americans.
I think at one point, you know, we were an NPR affiliate, so we had... I think at one point we actually had a wire. So I think that was part of this. I can't remember exactly, but I think we had a wire, and that was kind of part of the, you know, part of the news. But the major thing was, you know, the local news. I do remember, you know, somebody reading national news when they had that unfortunate toxic shock epidemic that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was reading, you know, some copy that I don't remember if we had AP or UPI or what, you know, or there, I don't remember what it was exactly, but she was reading the copy from that, and she got tongue-twisted and started to laugh, and we had to really apologize that it was a very serious topic because, you know, people were dying.
Sure.
But she didn't mean to be laughing, but she had just got tongue-tied. So.
But you know, it's happened to every one of us. You know, a couple of other events nationally that was going on.
Yeah.
Of course, John Lennon is shot by Mark David Chapman. Iran was really big in the news. Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980.
Dr. Ernest Sternglass had graver words. Sternglass has conducted studies of the area near Three Mile Island since the accident. He's found a link between the radiation released during the accident and increased numbers of infant mortalities and birth defects. And, according to Sternglass, this is not the only thing the radiation has done.
The real tragedy is still really the important fact that so many of the children around Three Mile Island and other nuclear plants that have been discharging gases and liquids into our air and water, that around these plants, the subtle effects of radiation are causing them to be slightly retarded, damaging forever many of their best capabilities. that if we want to see a healthy nation and a world in which children do not have to worry about their ability to go to college many years later, to do the things they want, to be creative, to do the kinds of writing and reading, and to enjoy a full life, if we want to make sure that our children can enjoy it, then we must find other ways of generating energy than nuclear. There is no other alternative.
The Oregon primary is tomorrow. Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter are expected to win the nod in their bids for nomination for the presidency. There's more at stake tomorrow than presidential delegates, however. There are many local officials to be selected and state and local ballot measures to be decided. In the Portland area, issues like solar energy, highway construction, water fluoridation, and zoo financing will be on the ballot. One of the most interesting races in the state is Ron Wyden's challenge of Robert Duncan's seat in Congress. That race in the 3rd Congressional District is said to be too close to call right now. Portland's mayor might also be selected tomorrow if one of the candidates gets more than 50% of the vote.
So there were a lot of other events that were taking place. Now, when you stepped back from the news after Ross began his tenure here, what did you do after that?
Well, I actually, during that time, I was doing news kind of as part of my job as volunteer coordinator. But I was also training everybody, you know, to learn how to use microphones and to check out the equipment. And so I continued, you know, doing that, and I was assisting Jonathan Potkin, who was the program director, and he was, you know, an amazing classical music aficionado. And he and Phyllis Radinsky were always arguing over the phone about, you know, what was on the classical programming. But, you know, he was a visionary in that way. And we had, you know, but at some point, he got a better place to work. And so he left his job as program director, and Michael Wells decided to have me be the interim program director. And so I did the scheduling of programs, and I did, you know, I didn't have the classical background that Jonathan had, but, you know, I knew a little bit about blues, and I knew a lot about folk, and I knew about, you know, news and public affairs. So I, you know, I pulled it together, and I, you know, ran the program committee and, you know, just started, you know, running the station. And we had been advertising for a program director, and we kept, you know, getting all these, you know, resumes, you know, from all over the, you know, country. And
who wouldn't want to come to Portland?
That's right. But one day Michael Wells sat me down and he said, you know, I don't think we want to interview any of these people. And I said, well, why not? And he said, I think we actually found the person that we'd like to be program director next. And I was like, oh my goodness, who is it? And he said, well, you've been doing an amazing job for 3 months, and, you know, the board would like to just, you know, keep you on as program director. And I was like, wow, you know, okay, you know.
So in keeping things in focus time wise, was this like after 1980, or where were we at time wise there?
It was probably 2 or 3. I was on staff for 5 years, and then I was a volunteer for another probably 10 or 15 years after that. So I started in 79. I was 23 years old at the time when I got promoted to program director, and I'm born in 1957. So if you do the math, you can come up with the year.
All right. Now, you have a strong, rich history with KBOO.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about this off air, and what I'd like you to do, if you would, is if you have any particular story or memorable events that took place during that time in history that you were here, why don't you share some of that with us?
Okay, thank you. What I would say is my fond memories were all about all of the program changes and about the program committee and all about, you know, the hundreds of, literally 300 volunteers And it was like herding cats, you know. So, you know, being program director, you know, I would get new ideas for programs. And one of the first one was Richard Francis, and he had a show of alternative music called A Different Nature. And, you know, the program committee absolutely loved that and approved it, and, you know, that got on the air real easy. And then Daniel Flasis came, and he wanted to have his show at 3 in the morning called Nocturnal Emissions. And, you know, I told him, you know, wow, Daniel, sounds like a great show idea, but, you know, the FCC would, you know, could actually shut us down if we have something on the air that is, you know, potentially, you know, not in the public interest or something. And so I, you know, he changed it from Nocturnal Emissions to Nocturnal Transmissions, and so that is the show that he got, you know. And then there was Mos Musica, and a show, you know, that Shahid Hamid and Muhammad started, and you know, there was a show called Mos Musica, and a show that Eugene Rashad did. And but all this time, you know, George Page had been there for years. And, you know, he was an African-American programmer. He was a master blaster on the weekend. There was JW Friday on Friday night. And, you know, all these, you know, I was getting this word from them and from the community that we really needed to expand our African-American programming. And, you know, all of these classes of people that I was doing training in, you know, audio production, most of them were, you know, most of them were white, like me. And I just, you know, I just really had it in my heart that I wanted to, you know, make these program changes.
If you're just joining us, I have Sheila Rubin on the phone with us. Sheila was with us in the late 70s through the 1980s and is now in San Francisco, or the Bay Area.
Yep.
Before we took that time out, you were reflecting back about some of the programming that was going on. Why don't you jump back in there, if you would?
Well, you know, what I would say is KBOO has an amazing program charter. And the people who started KBOO, you know, have an amazing, you know, vision of what they wanted to create of alternative radio. And where things had gotten to when KBOO started was, it was, you know, a lot of the, there was no classical music in, you know, in the area. And so KBOO started with primarily classical supporters and classical listenership. And by the time, you know, now we're in the early 80s, there's more people of color needing, you know, space on the air. There's more people, you know, really, you know, needing, you know, the alternative. What was alternative had, you know, changed. And there was another classical station on the air at this time. And so, you know, I was getting this movement from the community and, you know, from people that really wanted to be on the air, that we needed to have more African-American programming. So I took, I don't remember if it was 6 months or a year, but I took a significant amount of time and met with all the different program committees, the classical programmers, the folk programmers, the blues programmers, the, you know, public affairs programmers, the, you know, there were others that I'm forgetting, you know, the women's soul programmers. And, you know, asked all of them, you know, about how we could shift the schedule to make room for an actual, you know, strip of African-American programming. And we worked on it very hard. I did a lot of negotiation with all the different program committees and, you know, just a lot of work of coming up with this plan of, you know, and I was like, well, let's just, you know, try this thing for a couple months of, you know, if we take off the strip of classical programming in the evening and, you know, just for a couple months, and we put on African-American programming in the evening, and we serve that community, which desperately, you know, needs to have programming, you know, what would happen? And the board was like, oh, they can't, you know, we'll lose our listener base, we'll lose our support base, oh, you know, they were scared, and the classical programmers were not, you know, particularly excited about it, but somehow we all got on the same page, and the board finally okayed this. It was a very, very tense board meeting, but they finally okayed this. And, you know, there were a lot of people. It wasn't just me, but I was the program director, but there was, like, a lot of, you know, volunteers. I'm thinking of Shahid Hamid right now, but just a lot of people that really stepped forward and really poured a lot of energy into, you know, trying to move this forward. And the board okayed it, and we, you know, we did this, and it was amazing, you know, and we had this African-American programming strip, you know, 5 days a week during drive time. And, you know, we were getting new listeners, and we were getting people that were, you know, so excited, and, you know, how are we going to do this? And
you were just broadening your listener base.
We were broadening the listener base. And so it was very exciting to me, but this period of let's just try it for a couple months was a period where, you know, I started hearing from all different people. You know, I wasn't, you know, getting the thank yous I was expecting. I was getting calls from classical programmers and their, you know, people that used to listen to their show, you know, basically threatening me, you know, I can't believe it, you know, but just saying, you know, how dare
sure.
you do this? And I got, you know, calls from the African-American community, you know, threatening me and saying, don't you dare take this off. And I was like, I was the person that put it on. But they didn't know that. So needless to say, it got a little heated.
Mm-hmm.
It got a little heated. And in my heart of hearts, it was a very, very good thing to do. It was a bold thing to do, and I think it was the right thing to do. But, you know, what had been magical for me at the station was that, you know, we all cooperate, we all do things together, we all work together, we're all a team. You know, there was suddenly, instead of getting all this, you know, positive energy from everyone, there was, you know, a lot of, you know, I was getting a lot of phone calls of people, you know, in support of this and in support of that and
right.
you know, everything. And you know, and I was like 23, 24, I think it was 24 at this point, you know, and 25. And I, you know, I didn't know how to handle it. And I didn't know how to kind of step back and say, oh, you know, this is a major growth step of the station, and it's very profound what's happening here. And you know, how can I just kind of get my feet on the ground in order to kind of move forward with this? And
when all the time you were probably experiencing growing pains, and
yes.
the entire station was probably going through that same conditioning as well, and so it was probably something that was a natural thing to happen.
That's what I was trying to say. It was a natural thing. It was an organic thing. I was feeling into what was the most, you know, organic thing. What needs to come through this radio station at this time in its history? And that's what it was there needed to be more African-American programming. So I was bringing it through as part of my, you know, my personal vision, but I didn't know how to, you know, I didn't know how to, I didn't know how to have everybody be happy with it during
sure.
growing pain.
Sure. Listen, Sheila, what I want to do, I want to kind of change direction here.
Right.
And I want to ask you two questions. And the
uh-huh.
first is, amidst this economic climate that we've been in for the last 5 years, where we've seen all kinds of businesses, including radio stations, go dark. You know, it's been tough for people to make a buck. It's been tough for community radio stations and non-commercial radio stations to sustain their giving. What do you think it is about KBOO that has been the thing that made it survive for 45 years and for many years in the future?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question. I think KBOO gets at the heart and soul of what it means to be a communication service. KBU gets to the heart and soul of, you know, it's not just about providing programming. It's about, you know, what does the community need? And, you know, the fact that there are so many volunteers and people, they buy their own records, you know.
Sure.
To the jazz show. They what KBU is doing is it is coming from people's deep place of creativity and self-expression and wanting to give to more people and share, you know, what they understand about the world and what they understand about their lives through music, through expression, through news. And I think, I would love there to be more places like KBU. I miss it. I miss it so much. And I think KBU, the charter is, a living charter. And I think as KBU is able to grow with that living charter of being, providing alternative radio to the community, it's also coming from, the volunteers who
sure.
are, they're just giving and giving and giving of themselves.
Okay, let's look at the last question here.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is directed to you personally.
Okay.
But what I'd like to know is how your involvement with KBU has impacted your life.
Wow. That's a profound question. I was so in love with KBU when I was there. It felt to me like I was able, when I was there on staff as production coordinator and then as program director, I felt like I was giving all of what I had to give, my communication skills, my heart, my connection with people, my, passion for people's self-expression, just so many things. I was, coordinating people, it was like so much of me was able to go into the station and these 300 volunteers. And that was like a very amazing experience. And even, after when I resigned being program director and I thought somebody else will be able to do this better. And I don't think that that's true, but now, 30 years later. But, I wanted to be honorable and see if somebody else could handle the program changes better
sure.
at that point.
Well, it had to have helped you in your future pursuits, especially in communication efforts, based on your new job or your new profession.
Yes, I went. I stayed as a volunteer for KBU for about 10 or 15 years. After that, I left. I did a show called Lentil Soup, and which was folk and blues and interviewing people about their creative process. And then I moved to the Bay Area, and at 35 I went to school to become a therapist and a drama therapist. So now I instead of the broadcasting at KBU, I do groups, and I work with individuals, and I work with families, and I help people tell their stories. I have something called Life Stories, which is a process I take people through, a 10-week group, and then they tell their life story for a live audience. So,
sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so I'm down here, and I'm doing very creative stuff in a different modality.
Absolutely. Sheila, I want to tell you I've been absolutely delighted to have you and to share in this conversation and to help us share in our 45th anniversary of being on the air in Portland. Sheila Rubin has been my guest, and you need to come back to Portland just to pay a visit to us here at the at the radio station.
Okay, I'd love to come back.
Sure, come on.
Thank you so much for your insightful questions and for your work at the station.
You're more than welcome. This is Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, a look back through 45 years of KBU Radio. I'm Dan Johnson.
Women are murdered by abusive partners every day. Kathleen Blankenship shot her abusive husband, who was also an ex-cop. She was sentenced to life in prison. She will tell you how she broke through the wall of blue and had her murder conviction overturned. Hear her story on Prison Pipeline, March 4th at 6:30 p.m.
Talk about a revolution. It's Independence Day.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening. The time is 7:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Hard Knock Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3. It's history. Never been done before. In this country. But I tell you today, rabbit hunting ain't fun. When the rabbits stop running and start fighting back.
We're talking about a subject where
what up, everybody? Welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we talk about Leonard Peltier and the effort to free him. We also talk with Boots Riley from The Coup about his brand new project. And later on, we round it off with Kev Choice talking about his brand new show.